It is Saturday, March 31st, 2012. We're broadcasting live from the Central Coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio. In the first half of Geek Speak, we'll be covering the geek news. In the second half, we'll be having author Goth Sundram on. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxel. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. In the second half of the show, we'll be speaking with geek author Goth Sundram about his new book, Brain Trust, 93 Top Scientists Reveal Lab-Tested Secrets to Surfing, Dating, Dieting, Gambling, Growing Man-Eating Plants, and much more. But in the first half, we'll be doing some geek news. And in the air room with me is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And Mr. Ben Jaffe, a freelance instructor, web developer, and media guy. Hi.
Hey there. How's it going?
My name's Lyle Troxel. Let's go ahead and get started with Mr. Ben Jaffe. What's going on when you get lost? That's right. Yes, do that first. That's good.
Yeah, we have a couple thank yous from people who called in to pledge to KUSP. So those are Dick and Marianne from Santa Cruz, Heidi from Palo, Colorado.
Canyon,
thank you. Rodney from Gilroy, Frank from Pacific Grove, and Anonymous from Pebble Beach, California.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, yes, to all of you guys.
You're welcome to call in during the Geek Speak news. We will do a break in a little bit to help you do that. The phone number, if you'd like to call in right now, is 888-777-1507. Okay, so Ben, people get lost all the time. So now, space news.
Yeah. Right. So I don't know if any of our listeners have ever gotten lost in space. Maybe Patrick Stewart or, you know, I don't know if he listens to the show. But anyway.
Danger, Will Robinson.
Exactly. Some researchers at the UK National Astronomy Meeting in Manchester are talking about a way to do geolocation, but in space. And so the principle is actually fairly simple. But first, we have to rewind and talk about neutron stars, which are actually one of my favorite topics. So what is a neutron star? Basically, a neutron...
Yes. What is a neutron star? Sorry, I wasn't doing my role.
Exactly. So a neutron star has a mass somewhere around 1.35 to 2 solar masses. So 1.35 to 2 times the size of our sun.
And the mass of our sun.
The mass of our sun. And its radius is 12 kilometers. So about the size of Brooklyn.
It's dense.
It's incredibly dense. In fact, a couple facts about that. If you were to compress the entire population down to the size of a sugar cube, that would be the same density as a neutron star.
That's a really uncomfortable sugar cube.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so what does this have to do with space locations?
Right. So if you take a neutron star... when neutron stars form, basically stars have a little bit of a rotation, right? So if you imagine if you're on a swing or something and you have your arms spread out and then you pull your arms in, you're going to start rotating faster and faster and faster.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what happens with a neutron star. When they condense from huge stars to things that are the size of Brooklyn, they start spinning really, really, really fast.
Conservation of angular momentum.
Conservation of angular
think
momentum.
Think of a ice skater as they pull their arms in they really fast.
Yeah.
And then multiply that by 10 billion.
See, I always thought that was magic with the ice skaters when I was a kid. I was like, how do they suddenly start spinning so fast? And then I figured it out. So neutron stars spin, usually they rotate once every 30 seconds down to once every 1.4 milliseconds.
Whoa.
So these things can go really, really fast. So if you take a neutron star and you make it extremely magnetized, then what you do is you get pulses of radiation coming out of the star. And as the star rotates, those pulses of radiation sweep across the sky like a spotlight would. Or right. Like a...
a beacon.
Like a beacon. Lighthouse, that's what I'm talking about. So you get these lighthouses in space, and these lighthouses in space are turning at a very, very specific rate, very, very consistent. They actually, their precision is better than our atomic clocks.
Wow.
That's how precise these pulsars are.
But really hard to install in a car.
Really hard to install in a car. So,
well, think about a mass. Like, think you have a car and how hard it is to stop that. Like, you have to apply the brakes for a while and you can't just stop on a dime. You have these things that are so massive in such a small area. The idea of stopping it or changing its momentum at in any point to any, you know, even past a marginal amount is
these pulses not must possible. Be very fast.
Well, some of them. I mean, some of them are like, you know, pulse, pulse, pulse.
Depending on the speed.
And some of them are, you know, incredibly fast. I mean, 1.4 milliseconds. That's you know, over 500 times a second.
And now I'm seeing how this story correlates to geolocation stuff on Earth because it's all about the clocks.
In fact, when pulsars were first discovered or seen, people thought that aliens were communicating with us because there were these regular pulses coming out, and they're like, "What's going on? Oh my God!" There's
okay. So how does it help? How does it help with navigation in space?
So if you think about the way our GPS system works, you have these satellites that are orbiting the Earth, and these satellites have very very precise clocks on them, and then they communicate with your device. And if the signal takes a little bit longer to reach your device or a little bit shorter, your device can figure that out about exactly how long it takes the signal to reach from the satellite to you. Therefore, you can figure out the distance between you and the satellite. You can figure out the distance between you and multiple satellites, and you can triangulate your position.
Right.
So if you can do that in space...
And that's basically GPS right there, right?
What yeah, that's GPS right there, except we
So in space, there's enough of these to do that?
Yeah, actually, there are a lot of pulsars. And the really cool thing about this is that anywhere in the galaxy, your positioning uncertainty can be somewhere around 10 kilometers. So you can position yourself to a position in the galaxy within plus or minus, say, 10 kilometers.
I have to upgrade my phone now.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Thank you.
It's ridiculous. So, GPS for your spaceship.
And speaking about travel, in a minute, Ben, you are going to tell us about airline travel. Well, I'm a side effect of that, at least. But first, Miles... How does Google cool their data centers?
With bathtub water. Water. No,
a lot of bathtubs.
Yes. In Georgia, in their data center in Georgia, data centers being where most companies in some fashion or another keep their servers.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be when you have a co-location, when you buy web access from someone, they have the servers in their data center. Or in the case of someone like Google or Facebook, they have many data centers with oftentimes hundreds of thousands of servers, if not more. Right. And that takes a lot of takes a lot of power. And one of the things that takes power is cooling them off. I'm sure you've felt underneath the computer underneath your desk.
Oh man, if anyone has like a Mac laptop.
Yeah. Or burning. The laptop sitting on your lap, you know, you're like, hey, this is heating up. Now imagine you have a server which is generating far more heat than that laptop is or your home computer because it is running at such a fast speed.
Right.
These huge fans that are blowing out there. But they're right next to other servers that are blowing a huge amount of heat. So you have to suck all this heat out. And one of the ways that data centers do this, get rid of that heat, is by using liquid cooling. It's one of the things that overclockers will use to get faster gaming rigs. And because water is just a wonderful, you know, heat transfer mechanism. Well, that was a lot of water. And
yeah, you think.
Yeah. And so Google thought, well, you know what? This water doesn't need to be consumed by human beings. It doesn't need to be potable. So why do we have to have the municipality go through filtering all this water and making it...
clean it to crystal clarity. We
right,
can drink
just
it.
So we can run it through our server.
Right.
So what they did was they talked to the water service in Douglas County, Georgia. Said, hey, give us your gray water. Give us your water that hasn't been treated for human consumption, but has been filtered of all the major particulates.
Right.
And they piped that through their servers instead.
So gray water, which it's normally in our systems, you provide one water source to a house, for example. That's why we use wonderful water to flow through our toilets. It makes sense that you'd have the gray water solution. The other thing is, like here on the Monterey Bay area, the water treatment facility, like in Santa Cruz, pumps that gray water back out to the bay because it's not good enough to let people drink it. Though actually it probably is. It just doesn't sound very palatable. So there's a lot of runoff going away into the ocean. And what they're basically saying in that area, let's pipe it through computers first and heat it up. What do they do with the heat? And where does the water go then?
Well, the water right now goes to their servers. It heats up, takes the, you know, transfers the heat from the servers to that water source. And then they use it to, for example, flush their toilets.
And they also heat their buildings when necessary with it as well, I heard.
Right.
It's very cool.
Now, yeah, because toilets, yeah, your poop doesn't care if it's warm water or not.
No, so it doesn't. You don't know that. You watch too much self-flush.
I'm pretty sure that I do know.
Oh, wait, you have an infant. You know a lot about that. Let's let's go ahead and, in a second, Ben, you're going to tell us all about why airplane travel is so wonderful. But first, oh, God. A lot of weight on you, right?
Right.
It's been 40 years since KUSP signed on. Throughout the decades, we've never lost sight of an overriding objective. KUSP is devoted to public service. Just as important, it's not beholden to any political, commercial, or editorial agenda.
In these days of hyperpartisan chatter that masquerades as news coverage,
that's true,
Geeky not included, the need has never been greater for a radio voice that is genuinely curious and civil.
That's true. The challenge for all of us is this. The majority of today's big broadcast conglomerates have no patience for the cost of maintaining a global news gathering organization that tells stories that go beyond the headlines, something public radio does every day.
You've already made the decision that KUSP adds something to your life, so it doesn't seem too much to ask you that give what you can afford to support this place on the radio that helps you connect the dots in our complex world.
Yeah, our contributing listeners are the largest and the most important source of funding for KUSP, and we hope you realize that your donation will play an essential role in keeping KUSP on the air. Because you listen and because you rely on the programs you hear, we're counting on your gift. And because you want us to return to our regular schedule, we're hoping to hear from you now. Your contribution will help wrap up this campaign by Sunday and make it the shortest in the station's history. So we have a goal of 1,800. That's our goal for GeekSpeak. And to start things off, we have a matching gift from Jennifer from Ben Lomond. So she'll match every pledge to KUSP up to a total of $500. So call now. The phone number is 888-777-1507 or KUSP.org.
Please do call right now. We can use your contribution. We'll continue to do the Geek News, and you can go ahead and halfway listen to us and call in. We'd appreciate that. 1-888-777-1507. Okay, Ben, why? What's the deal with the air travel?
I don't know about you, but I love the cuisine on air.
You're going to talk about airline food? Awesome.
Sal,
it's breakfast
steak.
Time.
It's so great. Yeah, I heard all these ridiculous statistics about how, like, fill-in-the-blank airline removed one olive from their salads and saved a humongous amount of money. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous how much food airlines serve on the air. In the air, we should say.
Oh, no, fantastic. You confused me completely.
Right. Well,
I was thinking about how amazing was how much they didn't. How much, when I've flown recently, it's like, yeah, $6 for this sandwich.
Well, right. I guess if you fly Southwest or, you know, the short flights. Well, I don't know. I've been to Europe a few times in the last couple of years, and definitely a lot of meals. And the only thing that they have in common is that they're all horrible, right? So why are they horrible? It turns out that there's an article in the New York Times about how the taste buds in the human mouth work great at sea level, but they actually don't work all that well when you're up at 10,000 feet.
Why?
Or higher.
Yeah. Or higher. Yes,
normally
exactly.
We're at 35,000, I think, is the typical cruising altitude.
I'd go with that. Sounds
so
familiar.
There are a couple factors. First of all, is for whatever, I mean, we don't understand the way taste works very well to begin with, right? But we do know that as the pressure goes down, your ability to taste goes down. And as the air gets more and more stale and dry, your ability to smell goes down.
Interesting.
And taste and smell are...
So we have machines that make us taste bad things. That's basically what you're saying.
Make things taste bad, yeah.
So here's
except
really,
ice cream.
Except ice cream. Ice cream is one of the things. That,
why?
I don't know. But check this out. It turns out that people consume a lot of tomato juice when they're flying and not very much on the ground. And this is... This is because the acidity of the tomato juice is kind of it's lessened when you're up in the air and your taste buds aren't working. So that's why, I guess that's why they serve so much tomato juice. It's just because it tastes less acidic, and the wines that they serve are more fruity, and all of the airline food is salty and spiced a lot more and kind of disgusting. I mean, you know, they're doing their best to compensate for the fact that our taste buds aren't working.
But it's really us.
We're the problem. It's our problem, exactly.
Yeah, I never knew that about tomato juice. I should try that up on a plane.
Do you not like tomato juice?
It's okay. It's just really acidic, and it's,
you know, I never buy tomato juice, but when I'm flying, I normally drink tomato juice.
Actually, me too.
No, why? Yeah, that is.
Really?
Yeah. I like tomato juice. I just never end up buying it at the store.
I didn't know until now. But I mean, that's why they offer it, is because apparently
this is why we listen to Geek Speak.
this is why I listen to Geek Speak for my news stories, right? Wait a second.
Wait a second.
That doesn't make any sense. So yeah, it's a really fantastic article. They also talk about packaging, freezing, drying, storage. How you can't use open flames on an airplane, so they have to use convection ovens. These are all things that kind of contribute to the food being more objectively bad. But of course, from a subjective perspective, that's kind of the issue, is that our taste buds just don't work up that high.
So Miles has some more news on airlines, but first we give us some thank yous.
Yes, thank you to Barclay from Big Sur. Thank you to Georgia from Santa Cruz. From Dr. Tom from Aptos. Barry and Troy in Monterey. Roger in Big Sur. Audrey from Santa Cruz. Maureen from Pacific Grove. Sue from Santa Cruz. And Carol from Pacific Grove, thank you for supporting KUSP.
We do appreciate it. Miles, do you have something a little geekier or a little high-tech about airline travel? Rather than just humans taste bad? Wait, humans bad taste have?
Humans taste bad. The bad sense of taste humans have.
Thank you.
High-tech. I don't know. There's always the TSA. Oh. I don't know how high-tech.
Oh, no. Yeah, okay, go ahead. It had to happen if we're talking about
there was going to be a conversation, or rather some testimony, in front of Congress, the House Committee of Oversight and Government Reform, and the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure hearings, talking about the effectiveness of TSA security scanning or their practices, whether or not it's actually useful security, or as been coined before by certain other peoples, security theater. And one of the biggest critics of them, Bruce Schneier, who has been a longstanding pillar of the security community.
Mm-hmm. He's well respected, definitely.
Yes, mostly in computers, but has branched out in general areas of security, was going to be a witness for this committee, to sit there next to a TSA representative and have a back and forth. And the TSA objected to his presence, and their statement was because he is currently involved in a legal case over the use of the backscatter scanners, the X-ray scanners, and he got bumped.
So he's an expert in this, therefore he's on a case about backscan, I'm assuming a problem with them, and because of that, he's not going to help fix the problem. he's been
right.
Muted to fix
it. Because he knows so much about it, and because he is taking an active role in bringing to light the issues with that, he's being barred from...
It sounds perfectly makes a lot of sense. In the system where you actually make the laws and you define how we're going to do things, go ahead and mess up as much as you want. We'll fix it in lawsuits. That's basically what they're saying, right? So, I mean...
Well, no, we won't fix it in lawsuits.
Well, that's what he's doing. He's theoretically suing the government about... I mean, I'm assuming that's what the case is about. I have nothing to do about the case. But it's really about that a lot of what's going on in security... And, you know, any geek that goes and does travel knows this quite fast. Because one of the things that geeks do is assess the situation and figure out a way through it, right?
Well, so it's not just geeks. This is not just geeks. This is someone... I mean, I'm sure survivalists have looked at this as well. I'm sure people who...
Well, I don't know.
Who,
it's
who
that
don't
mentality.
Like having to remove their shoes, but looking like, huh, how is this?
It's that hacker creative mind that I think geeks epitomize, that is this desire to figure out a problem and a solution and work through it.
I guess that's where I think we were being a little too conceited there. I don't think that it's a hacker mindset. I think it's the mindset, and as it's been applied to computers and hacking.
Okay.
Well, so for the me, mindset exists for, yes, for
all,
us.
I'm assuming all of us have this experience. You go on an airplane and you go, oh, I could get past that security. I could get a bomb on this plane, no problem. Like, that mentality goes through me the entire time I'm flying.
Yeah.
Now, of course, well, it's all an intellectual debate and whether it's possible and how safe it is. But when you have people ask stupid questions or go through a procedure that doesn't affect that at all, it really it frustrates you. You go, wait a second, why are you having them do this? This doesn't make any sense. Okay, in any case, TSA is not hearing the people it needs to hear in when creating the new rules and regulations. That's sad. Depressing. Space news now. Ben, what's up with the shuttle?
Gosh.
This is also depressing and sad.
I'm spacey today.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's depressing and sad. It's not the right way to do it. I mean, the security theater thing.
No,
yeah,
not
yes. the space thing. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. You're reading my mind. You know what my story is, right? It turns out that
it says shuttle retirement on the storyline, and I go, that's sad.
Shuttle retirement.
But go ahead.
So there's a great article on, it's called Inside the Mummification of Space Shuttle Discovery. And I'll just cover this briefly because it just makes me too sad. But the shuttle Discovery is being, as they call it, mummified. In other words,
space mummies.
Well, luckily they've taken.
Hey, there was a Battle of the Planets.
Ben, you're never doing a story.
Of space mummy. There was.
There was. Yeah. I believe you.
At
least they won't get lost.
If you combine all of my stories together, you can actually navigate yourself through space and everything on Discovery. Well, it turns out they're next month in April. They're going to be sending Space Shuttle Discovery aboard the SCA. That's the humongous plane, the modified plane that is used to transport the shuttle. They're sending it to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum at Washington Dulles Airport, and they're going to put it on display. But before they do that, they have to do a whole bunch of stuff to make it safe, you know, because it's a shuttle. It's meant for you know the rocket engines and the I don't know. So. So they've spent about $28 million on, as they call it, mummifying the Discovery shuttle. I just wanted to hear you do that again. I'm glad you took the bait, right? So Discovery, just to recap, has gone on 39 missions. I don't know if you've looked at the odometer in your car recently, but it's gone 149 million miles. And it's spent exactly 365 days in space on missions.
Well, that's neat.
Yeah,
is that coincidental or they plan it out that way?
I don't know.
Now they are removing all of the engines, a lot of the electronics, but it's not because they're I don't think it's because of the security issues of someone looking and seeing, like, oh, look at those secrets, look at how they.
They're worried that someone's going to drive it out of the building and into space.
Yeah, Why are they pulling the stuff?
Because they're going to be reusing the rockets and some of the electronics in, I believe. Ares? No, not Ares rockets. Those are the really old ones. But they're going to be reusing it in other rockets to send payloads up. So they're going to be so saving money by reusing the same equipment put stuff into space.
I like the idea of preparing for mummification. And one of the things that mummies normally have is the brains were sucked out and all the soft tissue organs have been removed. Sometimes they're pickled and put around the room. So that's the metaphor you're going with.
I love it.
All right.
Anyway.
That's very cool.
Pretty cool. I expect that I will be going to take a look at it.
Yeah.
At some point soon.
Yeah. That's the thing is when it's in operation, you don't get to have that kind of look.
I'm so sad. I never got to see an actual shuttle launch. So now I'll just be able to see its sad corpse in the museum, right?
Geekspeak on KSP is supported by Cruise.io Works. Rentable workspaces located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz, featuring 40 new private offices, meeting rooms, an organic cafe, and 100 megabits per second Wi-Fi. More information is at cruiseio.com/cruiseioworks or at 459-6301. We are, this is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxel. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam and Mr. Ben Jaffe. Howdy, guys. One of the shows that I listen to all the time on KUSP is The Seventh Avenue Project, and tomorrow, John Hodgman became everyone's favorite fake expert. Hodgman, who plays the resident expert on The Daily Show and recently released his final book of complete world knowledge, joins KSP's Robert Pauly to talk about his unlikely career. Hodgman discusses the nature of authority in the digital age, truth versus artistic license, and the surprising inspiration for his professional persona. That's John Hodgman on The Seventh Avenue Project, Sunday, tomorrow, April 1st, no joke, at noon on KUSP.
And some more thank yous going out to Mark from Santa Cruz, Jane from Santa Cruz, Hunter from Salinas, Michael from Seaside, Carl from San Jose, Betsy from Aptos, Joni from Felton, Ed from Santa Cruz, Margaret from Watsonville, who is a new member, by the way.
Oh, good.
Michael from Ben Lomond, and Mary from Santa Cruz. Thank you for your support of KUSP and GeekSpeak.
Thank you so much for that. We would love to take your calls with questions, with support for the station. We're not doing calls with questions and comments. We do have our guest on in just a few moments, Garth Sundrum. He has a fun book called Brain Trust. We'll be getting into that discussion in just a moment. But first, I want to let you know, when KUSP signed on in 1972, an FM radio station was anything but a solid business proposition. No one could have foreseen how the market value for FM radio stations would skyrocket. And then, in the 80s and 90s, media conglomerates borrowed hundreds of millions of dollars to invest in FM radio licenses. So, it's not surprising that Wall Street came to demand big returns on those investments. In the hyper-consolidated era, big broadcasting companies are putting profit over public service in ways that were unthinkable in a few years ago.
And news departments got smaller or disappeared altogether, and music formats that couldn't draw a mass audience were tossed aside. Here at KUSP, we think that profit isn't the only measure of whether something should be on the radio.
Because you share the belief that the value of every human endeavor cannot be measured by a spreadsheet, we're counting on your support during this campaign.
The web address is KUSP.org, or you can call us at 888-777-1507. So far we have $400 and we have $1,400 to go. So that's pretty good. We're on our way. If you're thinking of giving for the first time, you can have a real and immediate impact on the success of this campaign because we're trying to finish on Sunday. Suggested amount, $1 million or whatever you can afford. It would really, really help us. Once again, web address is KUSP.org and phone number is 888-777-1507. So give us a call.
Please send in your pledge before the space mummies get us.
Or just Miles. He's sitting next to me. This is terrifying.
Yeah, I just want to let you know that we did for the Geek Bit this week, brought by a listener. A cop just knocked on my door and told me my dogs were chasing people on bikes. And I told him, that's impossible. My dogs don't even have bikes. Let's go on to our...
And Mundaka, a Spanish-style restaurant in downtown Carmel. Mundaka's tapas combine traditional Spanish fare with local ingredients complemented by Spanish wines and a full bar. Sample menu, live music calendar, and other information are online at mundakacarmel.com.
Garth Sundrum is the best-selling author of Geek Logic, The Geek's Guide to the World Domination, and Brain Candy, and you can find him at garthsundrum.com as the puzzle master at Wired's Geek Dad blog and at TED.com and or by using a searchlight to broadcast the periodic table of the elements into the night sky, he'll show up. Garth, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, Miles, Lyle, and Ben. How are you guys? Thanks.
We're well.
Pretty good.
I am loving your book, Brain Trust. It's a 93 top scientists reveal lab-tested secrets to surfing, dating, dieting, gambling, growing, man-eating plants, and more. Great subtitle, by the way. I like the explanation point. But what it is a really wonderful collection of common knowledge ideas supported by science and how they're supported by science. Is that a good summary for you, for your book?
And I wish that I had included space mummies. I should have maybe listened to this show. Yeah, exactly. I wanted to elicit that noise before we went any further. Yes, I called about 130 scientists and cut it down to 93 that are included in the book. And I talked to them about things we can do with our lives. Like I talked to the eminent cognitive psychologist, Steven Pinker, about how to bribe cops and sleep with coworkers, and all sorts of goodies. It was fun. And if I'd known what a pain in the neck it was going to be to call 130 scientists in 6 months, I don't know that I ever would have written a proposal, but I'm glad I did.
It is a lot of work to call that many people?
Yeah. Oh,
but
it was crazy.
They're fascinating people,
though. Nothing of worth has ever been done that someone said, if I had known how much work it was going to be, like, everything. If you knew how much work it was going to be, you would never get into it, and that's how any good project, comes to fruition.
That's calling someone every 17 hours and 20 minutes. That's a lot of phone calls.
Thanks for the math. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, okay. That was actually very well done. It was about a scientist every workday for 6 months. And
wow.
you know, wasn't
but you took weekends.
Scientists. I think they work weekends, but they don't take phone calls. No, it was actually really fun.
No. They just don't take your phone calls.
That's the key.
So, Garth, let's go ahead and go through a few of these examples. The wonderful thing is that I don't need to read this example. I can ask you to tell us the story. But since we've been talking about mummies, let's talk about other carnivorous things, like huge carnivorous plants, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, so this one's actually a ringer. I have a very few ringers sprinkled through the book, but my college friend Louis runs an entomology or an ecology lab up at UC Davis. And so right by you guys, or sort of right by you guys, he was wandering in the Sierras one day when he noticed that the carnivorous plant growing next to the pile of deer poop was the largest carnivorous plant. So he thought, what drives size in carnivorous plants, you know, like fly-catching plants and whatever. And he found a recipe by which you can alternate fertilizing the roots and offering it flesh in order to promote massive growth of carnivorous plant size, which is kind of awesome.
Feed me, Seymour. So, how big can he get these carnivorous plants? And I'm assuming they are catching flies, right, and eating flies traditionally?
Yes, and there are places in the world where carnivorous plants catch and eat mice. By sort of doing this technique, you can double the expected size of a carnivorous plant. So if you have, there's like a 2-gallon carnivorous plant in Borneo.
Whoa.
You know, it's got fluid and it waits for something to fall into it.
Yes, I've heard of those types.
Rajana's Pinta or something? Anyway, so imagine you had a 2-gallon carnivorous plant. Yeah, and you can make it into a 4-gallon pitcher plant. That could probably catch, I don't know, what, like your neighbor's little dog or something.
Chihuahuas go.
Yeah.
So this was a ringer in the sense that he was a friend of yours. You want to support his work because it was awesome.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, let's go ahead. Let's talk to a physicist, Cleveland State University, Gerald Walker, throwing a punch. What did he have to tell you?
So first of all, he is awesome. He's the author of the venerable physics book, Flying Circus Physics, and what he said is that instead of, you know, jumping up into the air and doing 3 flips and coming down with a heel strike, you are much better at better off bracing yourself against the floor. You want to use the physics of your braced body to throw a punch. He said that this is one of the reasons Rocky Marciano was so powerful, is that he was actually shorter than most of the people he was boxing against. Mm-hmm. So he could brace against the floor and punch up. Now, Walker also said something about arm extension. He filmed punches and then went frame by frame to calculate, you know, how far the hand traveled and thus the velocity of the hand.
Yeah.
And he found that the highest hand velocity is at 80% of extension. So, you know, when you hear Bruce Lee movies saying, you know, imagine your punch, you know, exploding within the body of your opponent, that's actually proven by physics to be exactly right.
Meaning that you really want to be closer to the target than your full extension so that you've got your full speed and therefore your full force. Cool. Now, this isn't exactly, I just gave some examples of kind of some violent examples from your book, eating plants and punching people. This is not all it's about by any means. There's 93 of these things, and I'm just grabbing ones that I thought were kind of fun radio content. But you can also talk about like how to be a taller person. No, but how to be a better basketball player.
Yeah. So, okay. I talked to John Fontanella at the Naval Academy, who wrote about basketball, and he found a couple things. So everyone knows that the more straight down a basketball comes, the bigger the hoop looks, right? Because, you know, you come at an angle and you're going to hit the rim, whatever. And if you're coming straight down, you can actually fit two basketballs through the thing.
Really? Is that how big a basketball hoop is? It's two basketballs?
Yeah, totally. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought of that. You'd never think. Yeah, I know. Because I can never put one in.
I can't either. Two, Miles can. He's pretty
that's
good.
That's the point.
I have this stunned look on my face right now. Like, really?
We have to go. We're gonna. Miles, Bennett, and I are gonna be out at the basketball court later today with a tape measure to check that out. So what you're saying is that the angle of entry, denotes how kind of wide the ball looks to the balls from the, or the hoop looks from the ball's perspective. So if it's really a sharp angle,
exactly right. Yep. But the higher you shoot a ball, the longer the overall path. And error is magnified across distance, right? So you want the ball to come as straight down as possible, but you want to balance that by taking, you know, the shortest point to the hoop so that your error is not magnified.
Mm-hmm.
So what this guy found is that the optimal angle to shoot a basketball, it's kind of hard to like say over the radio. I drew it in the book, but imagine like your hand is below the hoop, right? And you're going to draw a line from the tip of your fingers up to the rim.
Okay.
And that line is at an angle, right?
Right.
So take half of that angle, add it to 45 degrees, and that's the angle that you should shoot
a
basketball.
That's a lot steeper than I would have thought it. Yeah.
Well, it depends on where you are, because if you're out past the three-point line, that angle gets pretty shallow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the angle that connects your hand to the rim.
But you're never doing less than 45 degrees.
No, you're never doing less than 45 degrees unless you're shooting from above the hoop. That, you know, that is usually where I shoot from, of course.
Yeah, right, of course.
Of course.
I'm 13 feet tall.
That's where my kids sometimes shoot from when I hold them on my shoulders. Yeah,
exactly. So that might be why I'm so bad at basketball.
Yeah, mine too. Yeah, I was talking with my four-year-old.
Uh-huh.
So if you're shooting from above the hoop, the angle would, you know, point down from your fingers to the rim, and you would actually end up subtracting that from 45 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
But for mere mortals, you know, whoever they may be, you're adding half of that angle that connects your fingers to the rim to 45 degrees, and that is the optimal angle to shoot a basketball.
Okay, when you had this day conversation, you know, this conversation about basketball shooting, what about using the backboard or not? Should you always try to use the backboard or not?
Oh, I have no idea.
Oh,
but,
you
know, that actually brings up a funny point. Like, talking to these people. So when I wrote this, I imagined I would read a lot of papers and read a lot of abstracts and kind of, you know, write a book. And then I started, you know, calling these people and I would have a couple questions. But invariably, you know, 5 minutes into the conversation, we would sort of spin off into other realms. And that is what I would end up writing about. Like, I talked to the puzzler and mathematician Ian Stewart, and I thought we were going to be talking about, you know, card tricks and all sorts of stuff. And then he started telling me this story about how he's trying to use rotational mechanics to get his malfunctioning cat to land on its feet. And how,
what do you mean malfunctioning cat? Is it a robotic cat or a normal cat?
No, it's a normal cat.
Okay, his sick cat. Okay, cool.
His cat from progressively higher heights onto a cushion, you know, back first, trying to train his cat to land on his feet. And he figured out, you know, how a cat effectively like independently twists its front and back halves to create the rotation needed to get from back to foot side down. And so he's like twisting his cat and dropping it, which makes a much better story, you know, than card tricks. Or I talked to this guy, Wayne Winston, who is Mark Cuban's former stats guru for the Dallas Mavericks. And, you know, so I talked to him about how to bet sports. And there's some cool stuff there. But what's funny is when we're on the phone, he's, you know, yelling at LeBron James. He's like, LeBron James can't hit a jump shot. And because his model predicted a wider point spread for USA basketball. So these 93 problems in the book are not just some sort of ivory tower take on ha-ha science. I was totally chuffed and surprised and enthused to find that these scientists, you know, they're like preteen girls with a Justin Bieber crush. about whatever they study. And
yeah, they're totally into it. Absolutely.
Awesome.
I love speaking with people
totally
that are totally into what they do. Absolutely. I'm speaking right now with Brain Trust author Garth Sundom. He has multiple books out. His book is a blast to grab. I've been reading it for the last week or so. We're going to go through a few more of the stories in this book because they are fun. I do recommend the book itself because, of course, some of these things like the basketball description we just did, subtract 45 degrees from half the angle of the line of your hand to the line of the hoop, kind of hard to understand on radio. Really easy to understand the book, I have to assure you. So, Garth, you'll stay with us, and we'll be continuing discussion about your book and talking to wonderful scientists.
Excellent.
So there's been a lot of news lately about talk radio, especially the kind that engages in personal attacks and vilification.
Although one host or another may come under fire for using inflammatory language, it's only a matter of time before the controversy fades and the transgressor is back behind the mic. That's just the way things are when profit drives programming decisions.
It's unfortunate. Because you're a regular KUSP listener, you know there's no tolerance here for name calling or rude language. And our objective is completely different, to take apart complex issues and make them understandable. We want to hear a full range of opinions, and we want our talk shows to feed our appetite for understanding how the world works so we can make informed decisions as people.
Instead of listening to KUSP to just have your opinions reinforced, you come to us to broaden your horizons. Because our distinctive style of news reporting and conversation is worth your time, it's also worth supporting.
And remember, by making your pledge now, you can help us make this spring campaign the shortest in KUSP's entire history.
That's right, and you can do that right now. We want to work in partnership with you to end this campaign as fast as possible, and we're giving you every reason we think of to become a KUSP member. You understand how public radio works, and you understand the link between the programs you hear and the listeners' contributions. Assuming we've made our case, the next step is yours. You can almost certainly afford to contribute because we're only asking you to give what you can give. I'm going to suggest a $20 a month contribution to KUSP. That's $240 a year. It's actually not a lot of money when you break it down to a daily kind of thing. And it's very affordable for most people. So please do consider contributing to KUSP at that level or any level that works for you. You can do that right now. You define how you contribute. We just need you to do so. www.kusp.org. 1-888-777-1507. Again, that's 888-777-1507.
And please join Graydon from Santa Cruz in becoming a new member to KUSP and supporting our push.
And to Jennifer from Ben Lomond for this contribution is still up and going. You can match dollar for dollar every contribution you do right now by calling us and giving us your contribution. And thank you, Jennifer, for making that possible. We still have a goal of $1,400 to go during this next 15 minutes. I urge you to do so we can get our pledge drive ended as soon as possible and get back to the wonderful things we do on radio, like talk to Garth Sundom about his book Brain Trust. Again, the phone number, 888-777-1507. Again, that's 888-777-1507.
And keep the space mummies at bay.
That's right. Okay, one of the subtitle covers you've got, Garth, on your cover is dating. What do scientists have to say about dating?
A lot, actually. So I talked to Eli Finkel and Paul Eastwick, who were at Northwestern but have since gone their separate ways, and they continue to write together. But they mined speed dating data to come up with some absolutes. For example, in platonic situations, it's good to like everybody. By liking everyone, you are liked in return. But in romantic situations, they found that speed daters who rate everyone else highly are themselves rated low, and that liking everyone in a dating situation comes off as desperate. Mm. So when you are dating, whether it is speed dating or not, you don't need to pretend to like everyone. What predicted success was the difference between a baseline like and special like. So when you're across from someone you actually like, you should actually show it. But the habit of pretending to like everyone just makes you seem desperate. They also found that the sex that sits is more liked overall than the sex that rotates. They explain this by the very act of approaching something makes you like it more. There's been all sorts of studies that have shown.
So in speed dating, really quick, I want to describe the room. You've got normally one gender or one side, one, half the people sit down at chairs, and then the other gender traditionally rotates around the room, taking certain breaks at each person. And so you're saying the person that sits still in the room is more liked generally than the person that walks in. That does make sense, because you're you do have to take your body and go to that person. Therefore, you're already initiating a connection to some degree. I'm curious, like the idea that if you show that you like lots of people, I mean, it doesn't seem like it'd be necessarily a causal solution to this problem, because if you are the kind of person that likes everybody, and therefore you would answer high on the statistical, other people are going to rate you lower. It doesn't necessarily mean that let me put it this way. If I'm speed dating and Ben is the first person to come up and check me out and say hi, and then I'm really nice and like him, then Miles comes along. Miles doesn't know that I like Ben, right? And I then like Miles. That looks, potentially that could look that like you like them only. So I guess you could downplay the other people that you like. I would assume it has much more to do with, no?
Well, no, it's, okay, so you're absolutely right, and that's a great point, and it seems like you should be able to do that. The fact is you can't, and what Finkel and Eastwick found is that not only are likers themselves unliked, but people are astoundingly good at discovering the flavor of someone's like almost immediately, whether it's general or whether it's unique.
Yeah.
I wish you could fake it, and I bet a lot of other people wish they could fake it, but you cannot fake a unique versus a general like. It's something that people are extremely good at spotting.
So it makes sense then that people that are generally liked by lots of people actually genuinely like lots of people. Would that correlate your work?
That makes sense.
Yeah, very cool.
And you know, you're right that, you know, just like flipping a coin, it seems like every individual event should be independent of every individual event that came before. It's not like, you know, if you flip four heads, you're, you know, destined to flip a head or destined to flip a tail. But unfortunately, there is carryover in a person from any of these dating situations to the next. Like, you can't fake the flavor of your like.
Right. Absolutely. That makes sense. Well, Ben, are you single right now?
Yes, I am.
So you've been taking notes. Okay, good.
I've been taking notes, actually, yeah.
And something Ben does not need to work on at all, dieting. Ben's actually extremely fit. But before we get into dieting tips, Ben, we get some thank yous?
Yes, I have a couple thank yous. Anonymous thank you. Who will match every pledge to KUSP up to a total of $500. He said, or she said, they really wanted to be supporting this show, and they challenged GeekSpeak fans to meet the match by 11 o'clock. So that's $500. If you call, your money is doubled.
888-777-1507. We've had some people call. Somebody call. Yeah. What do you thank you? Another thank you?
No, that's okay, it. That's good. The one.
Anonymous. Thank you so much. Please do call and get your money donated by this anonymous donor. I really do appreciate it. I like the idea of geeks calling in during GeekSpeak. Any tech people that you listen to the show regularly, of course you can call the rest of today and tomorrow, but we'd like to hear from you right now. 888-777-1507.
And actually, I do have a quick thank you to Jennifer. She had the previous matching pledge, and her pledge has been met. So that's pretty fantastic. And one more that just came in, Miguel from Santa Cruz. Thank you for donating to KUSP.
Okay, Garth, what's the secret to dieting? I mean, a scientific perspective.
So I talked to Sachin Panda down at SOC, and what he found is that even with calories kept constant, we are much better off condensing the time we eat to 8 hours a day rather than 16 hours a day. And so it doesn't have anything to do with calories. It has to do with the function of mitochondria in your liver. We are optimized for the very long period of time before we had electricity, where we could really only eat for 8 hours a day. Our mitochondria, so we shouldn't ask them to work while they're dividing. If they work while they're dividing, higher rate of DNA damage creeps into these little mitochondria buggers. And if we eat for 16 hours a day, they have to work while they're dividing. If you keep the time you eat every day down to 8 hours a day,
you are at much lower risk for all sorts of metabolic badness, including diabetes.
Wow. Okay, so what you're saying is our long daytime waking hours and that midnight snack thing that people do all the time, including me, you pull that out of your diet and really think about your body's need for rest, the multiple cells. You keep that down to 8-hour window, only eat within an 8-hour window. Your body's going to do a lot better. That's awesome.
The mitochondria in your liver, they need to know when you've taken the last bite of the day so that they know it's safe to replicate themselves. They know it's safe to divide. And if they're working while they're dividing,
bad DNA
damage creeps in. Yeah, it's bad.
Okay, that is really cool. All right, well then, see, I love knowing the science behind that suggestion, because there's so many fad diet stuff out there, right? You talk to anybody, they have their way of doing it. And you never really know what actually makes sense scientifically, what actually is proven, if you will, or at least case studies exist to show its use. So to see that you know, you need your body to be able to do its other functions, therefore stop eating within 8 hours of when you started every day, that's going to support me doing that. Miles, what about you? You think that's going to help you? You don't need help either, of course.
Oh, but you know what's cool? Check this out. So he overlaid the NASA nighttime lights map. You know, you shoot it from space and you see where all the lights are.
Yeah.
And it has this spooky overlay with the U.S. incidence of diabetes map. It's such a cool graphic. It's another one of these things that's hard to do over the radio. But you can see that, like, if people are awake at night, you know, they're eating, and if, you know, they're eating more than these 16 hours a day, the incidence of diabetes is way up.
The book is Brain Trust, 93 Top Scientists Reveal Lab-Tested Secrets to Surfing, Dating, Dieting, Gambling, Growing, Man-Eating Plants, and More. Garth Sundrum is the author. You can learn more about Garth. We actually have links to all this stuff up at geekspeak.org. So, Garth, thank you so much. We're in Santa Cruz, so it seems kind of mean to me to do this to the last minute, but what's the best tip on surfing?
Oh, so I talked to Paul Doherty at the Exploratorium up by you guys, and he talked about the physics of hanging 10 and why you can pretty much only do it on a longboard. You need a long lever to shove into the back of a wave in order to support the weight of yourself at the suicidal front of the board.
Garth Sundrum, thank you so much for being on GeekSpeak. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Learn more about Garth.
Have a great day.
All right, take care. GarthSundrum.com, strangely enough. You can find out all about this at geekspeak.org.
We have a thank you for Clyde and Coralitos, and we still have that matching $500 thing, so go out and call in by 11 o'clock. Do it now. You can do it.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. GeekSpeak on KSP is supported by Monterey Bay Unified Air Pollution Control District, with a reminder that air stays cleaner when residents choose composting or chipper over backyard burning. Read about environmentally sound alternatives for yard waste disposal at MontereyBayCleanAir.org. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KOSP.org. Please do call in. You do have a few more seconds. Call in now. When the phone starts ringing, that's when we count it. So 888-777-1507. Again, that's 888-777-1507.